I thought he just came out of a swimming pool. He was soaking. I looked. I said, wow. I said, are you okay? Now, when we get in with Putin, we need people that don't sweat.
As the president hosts delegations from 10 Southeast Asian countries here, White House staff members are lobbying both Republican and Democratic members of Congress on moving forward with a Supreme Court nominee.
And the Grammy goes to
Taylor Swift.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09, almost 5:10. It is Tuesday, and it's February 16th, 2016. Good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell for our Tuesday. The price of oil is clinging to $30 a barrel today, and we're coming off a day yesterday when the Asian markets were soaring. And today, well, let's open the envelope here. Hey, they're soaring again, but not as bad and not as high as they were yesterday. So I wonder if it's something to do with the American markets that are bringing them down today. Good question to ask maybe one of our guests later on today on The Opening Bell. But the Dow futures are also positive this morning, as you heard Vic say. They're up almost 200 points. The S&P futures are up as well this morning. So we're looking for what could be an open on the bell that'll be positive earlier today, later on this morning, as we get back to work here in the United States for another business week. Some other business headlines that we're following for you this morning. As I mentioned, crude oil is clinging on to that $30 a mark level as Saudi and Russia argue about the output freeze of that. This morning, oil is at about $29.88 a barrel. It's up about 44 cents. Also today, there are three signals that are showing the stocks may be on track for a rebound, both here in the United States and around the world. Some analysts say that because of the losses last week, that maybe we've hit the short-term bottom and there could be a bounce in the coming days, coming weeks. Both J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley have published notes saying that markets are oversold and are itching for a rebound. So that's also good news this morning. Let's bring in our first guest this morning. Dale D. Buss is a journalist for Forbes. He's chief executive at all at he's also a former Wall Street Journal writer. He's business, politics, culture, all kinds of topics are his forte today. You can find him on Twitter at Dale D. Buss. Dale, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to talk about ways that CEOs can win this debate over tax inversion deals. You've been talking about this and writing about this. Tell us what a tax inversion deal is.
Well, the problem with tax rates is that in the U.S., the typical corporate rate is about 35%, which in global terms is among the highest. And a lot of places, the rates may be 12% in Ireland. Elsewhere in Europe, they're 19%. So you see the temptation for an American company CEO to try in this environment, which is very obviously weak and perilous, slow growth. You know, you've been talking about the markets already this morning. A lot of gyrations in the markets, and CEOs, I mean, it's incumbent on them for their shareholders and their employees to figure out how to save money, right? So in a tax inversion deal, an American company can merge with a company that's based abroad, and often these are in Europe, where, as I mentioned, the tax rates are quite a bit lower. And if they change their headquarters, their domicile, so-called, to the other country of origin of the other company, then they can qualify as being headquartered there, and they can get that lower tax rate. So, for example, just to the north of us, Johnson Controls, the big company in Milwaukee, very recently merged with a company called Tyco, which is an American company, but it's based in Ireland. And through that, Johnson Controls is going to save hundreds of millions of dollars a year in taxes. And as I said, their CEO's first obligation is to their shareholders, not necessarily to the U.S. Treasury. So you can see why they would say, well, gee, we can change our headquarters. We can save hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes. We don't have to move all our headquarters employees or anything else to this country. Why not do it? And so that's the temptation for CEOs. That's why this has been happening, by the dozens over the last several years. And you can see why, because it's been happening, the federal government might want to put a stop to it or try to discourage it. So that's something the Obama administration has been doing lately as well.
Well, we're talking with Dale DeBus about this, and Dale, coming up in our next segment, I want to get into that further on whether, you know, the Obama administration has chimed in on this, but also some of the candidates on the trail for presidency have also chimed in. And we'll talk about that coming up in our next segment about whether or not this might continue. Right now, as we move up on 515, it's time to check traffic this morning. How are the roads moving, Mary Vandeville?
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, President's Day, a chance to rest and to relax for investors, a chance to collect their thoughts. Futures suggest a higher opening for the Dow, the S&P 500, and for the NASDAQ composite today. Asian stocks rose for a second day as increasing hopes for more central bank stimulus and a jump in oil prices gave overseas investors relief from the beating that the markets there have suffered so far this year. Benchmark U.S. crude was back above $30 a barrel. World oil prices may start to rise consistently now that four big producers have agreed to freeze their output at January's level. But Saudi Arabia, Russia, Qatar, and Venezuela say they will take that step, only if other major oil-producing countries do likewise. The diesel emissions scandal has finally caught up with Volkswagen. It's watched its sales in Europe fall 3.8% last month. European car and truck sales for Volkswagen had been surging for 2 years in a row. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program at 520. We're talking with Dale DeBus about tax inversion. Dale, before the break, we were talking about Johnson Controls and its merger with Tyco and it moving off to Ireland, perhaps. And you talked about the Obama administration's aversion to this, but also Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton has called the deal perversion and really slammed Johnson Controls for doing this. Is this not going away anytime soon in terms of the political discussion about whether this is the right thing for companies to do?
No, it'll very, very much be with us, I'm sure, right through the presidential campaign season at least. As I mentioned, the Obama administration tried earlier last year to say, okay, companies, CEOs, if you want to do an inversion deal, then if you end up owning less than 60% of the resulting company, you can't do an inversion deal. Well, Johnson Controls got around it by saying, all right, we'll just do 56%. So these deals aren't going to stop. And you mentioned presidential candidates. I mean, if you're a Democrat, you're thinking an American CEO's obligation should maybe be to the government and to taxpayers as well as to their shareholders. So as you mentioned, Hillary Clinton said, well, Johnson Controls has gotten hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks for various reasons from both the federal and state government, even going back to the auto bailouts in 2009. So, as you mentioned, Hillary called this deal, instead of an inversion, a perversion, and she said that Johnson Controls was walking away from its obligations instead of doing what it should do to support our country, which in her terms means continuing to pay those extra hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes that Johnson Controls wants to avoid through the deal. And for his part, Bernie Sanders called this Johnson Controls deal a disaster. And on the Republican side, hasn't been as much comment, but the Republican candidates generally think, well, maybe the problem here is the high tax rate on U.S. companies, and maybe that's something that should be looked at so that companies and CEOs are not tempted to do these inversion deals. So, you know, you've got an obvious difference politically on how the candidates look at this.
Yeah, and then there's also, you know, the flip side of that would be just the public at large saying, hey, wait a second, the Supreme Court has ruled that corporations are people, too, and that they're just like you and I as citizens. Is there a potential backlash here for, you know, the public reaction to these companies? And I'm thinking specifically, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Burger King, didn't Burger King want to move to Canada or is planning to move to Canada? And some of its customers are upset about that because I think that was an inversion deal too, right?
Sure, yeah. Burger King merged with Tim Hortons a year or two ago, and that was an inversion deal where Burger King now is officially headquartered in Canada, but it really hasn't affected its operations too much. I mean, I guess there's potential for backlash in the sense that the public generally may be fed up with some of the antics of CEOs, and you have this whole notion of income inequality, the rigged economy, all these terms being thrown around, especially by Bernie Sanders, who's getting people excited about the idea that, yeah, everything's stacked to benefit companies, you know, rich shareholders, CEOs, big companies, and that the whole tax inversion notion can be thrown into that. And maybe to the extent that people feel that we have a lot of needs in this country, you know, the infrastructure is falling apart, whatever it might be, and these hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes that companies are avoiding could be used to help with that. I can see people getting upset specifically maybe about tax inversion deals, but I think it just all goes in with the general anger that the candidates are stoking in a populist sense toward Wall Street and toward, you know, financiers.
Because you and I are paying high taxes as well, and it's not like we can just move our headquarters, our personal headquarters, to another country, can we? I mean, if you're going to
Right. Yeah. I mean, sure, but on the other hand, some people might say, hey, might understand that a CEO's obligation, you know, is first to his or her shareholders, and those shareholders are saying, hey, if you can save a few hundred million in taxes, that's your job to figure out how to do that. And if that means taking advantage of tax laws the way they are, you know, very legally, then do it. I mean, I guess in a way, you know, it might be kind of similar to Donald Trump saying all the time, hey, yeah, you know, I've had a company or two go bankrupt, but I was doing it legally, taking advantage, you know, in a business sense of what the law allowed. And, you know, that's my obligation is to my companies and my employees. You can see the same kind of logic being applied here.
And then there are some who will say this all goes back to the fact that there's just failed leadership at the top, that our governments should be dealing with these problems of taxes, high taxes, and keeping businesses here and happy, right?
Well, exactly. And you know, the argument, which nobody can really refute, how capitalism works is you give companies incentives to invest where their money is going to give them the best return, and then they create opportunity, they create jobs, they create economic growth. And the Republicans in all this and people on Wall Street will argue that's what this government, the Obama administration, has failed to do. They failed to give companies and CEOs the kind of atmosphere where they can, you know, go out and with confidence invest in the United States, even with the high taxes, and, you know, generate the jobs and the growth that obviously is so sorely lacking in this country, even, what, 5 years after the end of the recession.
Dale Buss is a contributor for Forbes. You can read his latest article in chiefexecutive.net, Four Ways for CEOs to Win the Debate Over Tax Inversion Deals. You can also find him on Twitter at Dale D. Buss. Dale, thanks for being with us on the Opening Bell this morning.
Thank you.
It's 5:26 now on the Opening Bell. Let's go to the newsroom, check in with Vic Vaughn to see what's coming up on the news. Vic?
Hey there, Steve. We are looking at the latest numbers for shootings and homicides here in Chicago, and what we're seeing is a lot more than just an uptick. We're wrapping up that report right now. Plus, we'll bring you more on this new operation being employed by the Illinois State Police to cut down on expressway shootings, which are also up, coming up at 5:30.
All right. Thanks, Vic. It's 5:27 now here on the Opening Bell, and we'll be back with more. Stay with us.
From ABC News, Tech Trends, putting touchscreen gloves to the test. Using your phone in winter can be a real pain, literally.
Annoying having to take off the gloves every time to just send a text.
Regular gloves won't work with touchscreens because fabric blocks the charge from your finger. Nick Guy with the tech blog Wirecutter says they make gloves with special material just for this purpose.
They actually sew in silver and copper thread that conduct electricity and allow you to use your touchscreen as if you weren't wearing gloves.
Putting several different brands to the test, Nick texted, used apps, and played games. He says at $29.99, the Moshi Digits glove was a cut above.
These were our favorite gloves in our test. We found that they were nice and warm, but we were also able to type really well with the thumbs on them.
Also impressive, the North Face Thermoball E-Tip gloves, which retail for $50. Another tip, get gloves with gripping material on the palm to help prevent your phone from sliding out of your hands, and look for a tight fit, too. With Tech Trends, I'm Karen Chase, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 5:37. Welcome back to The Opening Bell. The World Ag Expo, the 49th annual show, was held last week, wrapped up over the weekend in Tulare, California, and it set a record for the largest event ever. 2.6 million square feet of exhibit space. The three-day show housed more than 1,500 exhibitors, hosted a record-breaking 106,349 attendees from almost every country on the planet. Charlie Pitliano is the chairman of the Ag Expo, and he is with us via Skype this morning to talk about some of the new products that were featured at Ag Expo this year. Every year, the Ag Expo, the leaders of it, pick the top 10 technological and agricultural expo products of the year. And Charlie, I'd like to start with something called the Red Fox Paws. What is that?
It's a red button. If an operator has this tractor or motor running and he is operating it in the back, and if the safety don't shut it off, he has the ability of this red button that's on his body to shut that motor or equipment off, either for himself safety or for the worker safety.
Yeah, and without painting that gruesome of a picture, and for our listeners who may not be farmers, this, for instance, was a piece of machinery that somebody got their hand cut in or their piece of clothing. This button is sort of like a kill switch and shuts it all off, because every year there are a lot of these accidents that over time, over the years in the past, have claimed lots of lives.
You're absolutely right. It happened to me about when I was 20, maybe 20 years of age. My clothes got hung up on the dry shaft, and my father was on the tractor. If it wasn't for him being on the tractor shutting that off, I wouldn't be here today.
You mentioned the intelligent wireless irrigation control system. That's another one, considering you're focusing there on the drought. Explain how that works.
It's a moisture sensor that is put into the soil at different depths. So during the growing seasons, prior to the fruit being harvested and growing, the depth of water is very important, but not overwatering. So this sensor tells a grower when to irrigate and how long. And it has a red line and green line on it that tells us on our foam pad that we have irrigated correctly and for the period of time. And it tells us the next irrigation, when to start.
And one of the other cool devices that I saw on the list this year was the video-fied ag alarm system. Describe this, if you will. Why would it be important to have a video feed of your fields?
I'm going to tell you, the theft issue in California is extremely high on ag products and also on ag equipment. Monthly, daily, and nightly, there's always a thief coming around, taking a piece of equipment or pulling wires out of the well to go sell it. The cost to replace that is so high, let alone the downtime that we have to replace that was stolen. And especially when it comes to harvesting time, this video could watch if anybody is in the middle of the field picking our crops to sell it at the flea market come Sunday.
And the key to this is that it's sort of like a motion detector. As soon as it detects that motion, it sends you an alarm, right?
It'll send us an alarm, or we could have instruments send it straight to the sheriff's department.
Obviously, technology is going to be a big part of the future of agriculture. Do you think the public at large realizes how much technology is used in agriculture these days?
I don't feel like they know what high technologies we use. I feel like the public feel like we're throw a piece of seed in the field and it just grows and makes a crop. They don't have the idea what it takes to make a nut or what it takes to make a melon. I feel like probably over 80% of people don't know the money that it costs us to produce a product as a farmer does. Right now, it takes a college and doctorate degree to do all these technologies that's coming out just to keep in front of it. I always go to my grandkids to help me figure out the sensors, because he has computer knowledge that I never had in my days. The technology is so advanced. Just like computers, you buy one this month, and 3 months, you buy another one because it's faster and better. Same thing's happening to us, which is very expensive.
The stakes are pretty high here, aren't they? Because, I mean, without you guys succeeding, the whole world really doesn't eat, do we?
Like I told somebody last week, you know, just because Save Mart don't have oranges. That means you can go to Costco and get their oranges. One of these days, those oranges are not going to, you can't go down the road and pick them up. If we don't have the water to produce our product in California, the whole world is going to suffer. And they're going to suffer with bad blemish of fruit, and they're going to suffer with high cost of feeding. Well, that's why we have to get our hands around and our heads around our water issue in California, and our bureaucrats and their environmentalists has to get on the table, quit being so childish about saving the fish and not a human being. Figure it out that there's plenty of water for everybody, and let's get this done, because time is wasting. I want my children and my grandchildren to be farmers, but if we can't get this water issue solved in California, we're going to have a hard road to feed the world.
Are you optimistic about the future of agriculture, or are you growing increasingly concerned?
As I know agriculture today, as I've been a farmer since 1975 on my own, going to the future, I feel like it's going to be a change. Everybody is not going to like the change that's going to come down the pike to survive in California with our water issues that we have on the table today. We will have to swallow so slightly and just change so little bit to keep on producing our crops. I won't like it, but I really, it's hard for me to put my ranch in a suitcase and move to another state. It's not going to happen.
That's Charlie Pitliano via Skype this morning, the chairman of the World Ag Expo, which just wrapped up in California. The record-breaking attendance this year, only topping last year's record attendance, 106,000 attendees this year from almost every country on the planet. You can find them on Twitter at world_ag_expo. By the way, the dates have already been set for the Ag Expo next year. It'll be held February 14th through the 16th, 2017, at the International Agri Center grounds in California. It is 5:44 on the opening bell. Just quickly, let's take a look at what's happening on the futures. The Dow futures are higher this morning. The Dow futures up 178 points. The S&P futures up 21. Corn and oil are mixed this morning. Oil is at 29.72 a barrel. Let's find out what's happening with traffic this morning. Watching the roadways, here's Mary Vandeville.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
It's 5:48 on the Asian markets this morning. The Nikkei is up about 31 points. The Asian Dow is up 29. The Hang Seng up 204. The Shanghai up 91. Dow futures also pointing towards an open that'll be higher on Wall Street later this morning. Let's find out some of the latest commodity information. And good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Well, it was a quiet day in the marketplace yesterday, Steve, because of the President's Day observance. No markets in the U.S. traded, but there were some activities in foreign markets that will affect U.S. agriculture. Egypt's Agricultural Quarantine Authority has rejected four cargoes of U.S. soybeans due to higher than permitted levels of a fungus called ambrosia. The four vessels are around 30,000 tons each and are all of U.S. origin. The problems all happened this month. And then India, for the first time in 16 years, is going to import corn. But it has a strong stipulation. That is, there be no genetically modified organisms in the corn they're going to import. That's going to be difficult with the widespread use of GMO around the world. And then one other foreign note, the U.S. government has granted an Alabama company permission to build tractors in Cuba. Co-owners Horace Clemens and Cuban-born Saul Barenthal plan to self-finance a $5 to $10 million factory at the Cuban port just west of Havana to build small tractors for sale to private farmers and builders in Cuba. On the meeting front this week, fairly quiet. U.S. Grains Council gathering to talk about export opportunities at their annual gathering, this time this week, being held in Sarasota, Florida. I'm Orion Samuelson. Have a good day.
Thanks, Orion. You too. It's 5:50 now on the opening bell. Morgan Stanley has agreed to pay $3.2 billion to strike a settlement with state and federal authorities, Illinois among them, over Wall Street's firm creation of mortgage-backed bonds before the 2008 financial crisis. ABC News correspondent Aaron Katursky has been following this and is on the phone with us. Aaron, give us a sense of what this settlement means and what it's all about.
This is directly tied to the crash of the housing market back in 2008. And this is conduct that many banks were engaging in, and others have settled, and there's more to come. But Morgan Stanley, though not the biggest player, was contributing enough, prosecutors said. And what they were doing is essentially making misrepresentations to investors about the kind of investment products they were selling. These products were essentially big jumbles of mortgage loans, and many of them subprime. But they were pitched as very safe investments that had been thoroughly scrutinized by Morgan Stanley's crack team of investment product scrutinizers and certified to investors as safe. In fact, since they were loaded with subprime mortgages, we know that they were inherently risky, and that was never disclosed to investors. And it's that kind of conduct that led this settlement of now more than $3 billion. You ask, is it enough? It's a big number. And it will go to help land banks and mortgage reductions and other programs meant to help homeowners who are still hurting from this 8 years later recover. But if you were looking for somebody to go to jail over this, well, then, you know, this isn't going to help.
The New York Attorney General did say that he thought this was at least holding somebody accountable for that mess.
And that's what this whole effort is about. The Justice Department and state's attorneys general are trying to just hold these banks accountable. Still, no one's going to jail, and that's kind of what irks many. And it's come up on the campaign trail from Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton especially, you know, that there ought to be laws that say you can't do this and keep yourself out of jail. In fact, there's email in this case that was unearthed by the Attorney General's office here in New York and in Illinois that showed Morgan Stanley employees writing to one another, one saying, we're trying to fly under the radar on this. Please don't communicate about the higher risk involved in some of these projects. And then in another email, one employee asks another, can you work your magic on this? And that's a reference to scrutinizing one of these investments that was supposed to be a little more rigorous than the, you know, less than a minute rubber stamp that was ultimately given.
And you touch on a good point there. There's really nothing in place to keep this from happening again, is there?
Well, you know, it's a complicated question, and there's real questions as to whether what was enacted following the financial crisis is enough. And I think, by and large, the kind of mortgage-backed securities that were, you know, feeding into the housing crisis are probably not, as prominent as they were. However, you know, there's still some questions about whether conduct is specifically banned, whether things are too self-regulating, whether there needs to be better oversight. The Attorney General here said he would support changing criminal laws to make them a little tougher on individual bankers, because right now you could take an email that says, you know, we're trying to go under the radar on this. Don't communicate about this. We don't want to communicate the higher risk. But getting from that email to someone's house being underwater because of, you know, the housing crash is a very long leap for prosecutors to make beyond a reasonable doubt. And so they just don't think they can get at individuals and to hold them specifically accountable.
Has Morgan Stanley had anything to say about this? Is this one of these cases where they don't admit any wrongdoing?
No, in fact, that's what makes this somewhat different. Usually, it's true in these kind of white collar high finance cases, you don't get the institution to admit any wrongdoing. Here, Morgan Stanley concedes that it was doing this, and they really didn't have a choice because they were doing it. The email showed they were. And so that's part of the satisfaction, I guess, part of all this, that Morgan Stanley concedes it was making these misrepresentations. And as the Attorney General here put it, the system to go over these investment products, these mortgage-backed securities, really broke down completely. And so the bank acknowledged it, agreed to pay this fine, which will be New York.
Now, Goldman Sachs is still out there somewhere. Might we see another settlement like this with them coming up? Or where does that stand?
They've had this working group for several years now, trying to hold the banks accountable. We've seen Bank of America, for example, settle and J.P. Morgan Chase. So this is another domino to fall, and there are more. And part of the money it goes directly to homeowners to help, you know, write down some of their loan. It also goes to land banks to help get to let cities buy up distressed properties or foreclosed on properties before any kind of shady developer gets hold of them. So they're trying. But what's stunning is that this is still having fallout, and there's such a need for recovery funds 8 years after this all happened.
ABC News correspondent Aaron Katursky with us on the phone from New York about the Morgan Stanley settlement, $3.2 billion with state and federal lawmakers. Well, that's the opening bell for this morning. Thanks to our producer, Mary Sandberg, our engineers, Ben Cortez, production help from Ross Cochran and Kevin Powell. We'll see you tomorrow morning, bright and early, on the opening bell at 5 a.m. right here on 720 WGN. The Steve Cochran Show is next.